Pardon me, I'm having a time with my computer here, or the one I use. Well, Amy Goodman is not doing her column anymore. Why don't you write her and ask her to keep doing it? Because I'm excerpting something that would have been part of a really good column by hers, and I wish I could do as much as she did. She says she's putting a lot of energy into traveling the country on the weekends and fundraising for different kinds of public and community media and screening the film, Steal This Story, Please. Just trying to channel my inner Harry Shearer there. I should play some Harry Shearer. I'm just in a kind of satiric mood. Did you hear that the prospective ambassador to Iceland made a joke about it being the 52nd state? it didn't get in the news roundup. I guess, you know, it's a busy week, and yeah, we can talk about Greenland, but yeah. Wants to add another star to the field of blue. That would be a lasting legacy. Getting one of those and getting the Peace Prize would be, at the same time, would be quite an exercise. MLK weekend. I think Carol Ammon's giving the keynote over at the Cranard on Sunday at 5 to 7, is it? I'm thinking if it's on YouTube, I might twin that and listen to it from here. And letting the audience hear a bit of that official MLK weekend. Somewhere I have something about the event that's happening tomorrow afternoon by CURE, a CU resistance effort. They're calling for, I believe, a 2 o'clock gathering at Westside Park. And it has a clever hook about it being cold out. And I will find that before the end. Oh, here we go. Protest March, marking the first year of Trump regime, as well as celebrating MLK and his appeal for justice and peace. 2 p.m. Sunday, January 18th. They have a Facebook page. Wasn't inviting people in, but I think you can look at it or something. The list of many outrages goes on for a while. This is the fifth resistance effort event in 10 months. And they did a Good Justice Caravan through Urbana on January 11th, a bit of a response to the shooting in Minneapolis. I was thinking of playing the interview that was done last weekend on Pacifica with Mark Ritchie, who's former Secretary of State of Minnesota. And I don't know. The protests that I was talking about, people are encouraged to dress warmly and bring hand warmers because of the dangerous weather. I thought they had a clever thing, clever hook on this about the cold. Like I said, if I get out, I'll drive by and honk my horn. I don't think I'm standing out even for an hour in the cold. I've been fighting something for quite a while. As I mentioned, Amy's been talking about doing these tours. It would be nice if she could come to here, to the WEFT, and to the Media Center, maybe even WLL would host them, though they don't run anything. They don't even run alternative radio anymore. That alternates here on WEFT on Sunday afternoons, roughly alternating. It's also on Saturday morning quite early as part of the fair and the Peace Talks radio segment. It's before Peace Talks, so if you're insomniac and you want to hear alternative, it's in there. It's already 4 minutes in. So the Fairness Report mentioned the Washington Post journalist. There's a segment with Jamil Jaffer of the Knight Foundation that was on Thursday, and there's a second part that talks about a guy that's being called to testify to Congress this week. I don't think he's going to say no, because it might bring more attention to his story about drug trafficking in the Special Forces, the base that supported the kidnapping of Maduro, was actually implicated in some major drug trafficking. There's a long history of that, isn't there? It's usually the CIA, but I guess Special Forces getting into it as well. But he's being dressed down in Congress, which makes me think of the Clintons giving their regrets about not showing up. I'm willing to believe that Clinton was, when he was talking with Jeffrey Epstein in the White House, was not just perhaps being lascivious, but also might have been cashing in. Epstein was in Boston on the Harvard campus at the same time that the loan for shares scandal happened, which most people don't know what that was. That's in the aftermath of Yeltsin's, the Soviet Union collapsing, when much money was extracted out of the state enterprises of the former Soviet Union, Russia. And one of the places that specialized in that apparently was Harvard. They were supposed to be helping. I haven't heard Jeffrey Sachs actually talk directly about this issue, but I'm willing to believe that that Clinton might have been profiting, as well as doing perhaps some other notoriously, I can't think of the right adjective. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others. MLK Day, MLK's 1964 address to the Berlin Jazz Festival. Why there's not a recording in his own voice, and perhaps there is, but I haven't previewed that, so maybe I'll play it again on the outro. This is a presentation in San Francisco of his address. So this is my little MLK weekend event. Again, there's march at the Westside Park, 2 o'clock, Sunday. Oh, come on now. I guess maybe the... I better check my local listings here. You should do that, too, whenever you hear an announcement here, from me particularly. But here's someone voicing MLK's... thoughts on jazz.
God has wrought many things out of oppression. He has endowed his creatures with the capacity to create, and from this capacity has flowed the sweet songs of sorrow and joy that have allowed man to cope with his environment in many different situations. Jazz speaks for life. The blues tell the story of life's difficulties, and if you think for a moment, you'll realize that they take the hardest realities of life and put them into music, only to come out with some new hope or a sense of triumph. This is triumphant music. Modern jazz has continued in this tradition, singing the songs of a more complicated urban existence. When life itself offers no order and meaning, the musician creates an order and meaning from the sounds of the earth which flow through his instrument. It is no wonder that so much of the search for identity among American Negroes was championed by jazz musicians. Long before the modern essayists and scholars wrote of racial identity as a problem for a multicultural world, musicians were returning to their roots to affirm that which was stirring within their souls. Much of the power of our freedom movement in the United States has come from this music. It has strengthened us with its sweet rhythms when courage began to fail. It has calmed us with its rich harmonies when spirits were down. And now, jazz is exported to the world. For in the particular struggle of the Negro in America, there is something akin to the universal struggle of modern man. Everybody has the blues. Everybody longs for meaning. Everybody needs to love and be loved. Everybody needs to clap hands and be happy. Everybody longs for faith. In music, especially this broad category called jazz, there is a stepping stone towards all of these. To me, reading that statement and thinking about everything that was going on during the period in which this statement was written by Dr. King, it speaks to the beauty of the African-American experience, but also what musicians, in particular jazz musicians, were striving for musically and culturally alike during this time. The struggle is still continuing, but I believe that we as musicians have a deeper impact and a deeper meaning than just the notes that we play. And the social and cultural implications speak through our collective musical minds as we continue to speak for social change and racial inequality.
I think there is a recording of MLK giving that in his own voice, but I really appreciated that musical bit. That was very nice. I needed to relax. Yeah, Abu Jamal has been busy, and there's a German connection here, too. He's giving a little statement to a conference in Heidelberg, I guess it is. But he also has a commentary called Killing for Clickbait. This is from Prison Radio. This is a regular feature. It had also been up there with Amy Goodman's piece. I don't think I've even mentioned that most of the show is going to be a segment with Amy Goodman talking about a film. It's part two, All Left of You. This is about the Palestinian experience. And it's about 25 minutes long. And it's up for an award. Remember last year's award, No Other Country, the Palestinian partner with the Israeli that made that and accepted it. He was killed in the West Bank, the Palestinian one, not the Israeli partner. It's sobering. Last week I played a segment she did on a film called, made by an Israeli filmmaker. There was a part one and an off-the-air web exclusive. I played the web exclusive segment called Holding Liat, Liat being the first name of Liat Beinon, niece of Joel Beinon, who I go to on for anti-Zionist and insight in the region pretty frequently. Stanford professor emeritus, Middle East studies. But I don't know that that director has to worry, but then Rabin was killed, wasn't he? Assassinated. Because he even was thinking about peace, apparently. Not doing much about it. I already gave a disclaimer. Here's two segments from Mumi Abu-Jamal. Maybe he'll be more regular in posting these great commentaries, in my opinion.
Killing for clickbait. The shocking killing of 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good by a contemptuous ICE agent is a sad but true testament of our times. The nation is riven by conflict on a host of issues, principally the manner of how immigration is actually practiced in the real world rather than driven by online rhetorics. Good, a mother of three children, had just driven her six-year-old son to school when she returned to volunteer for her neighbors in Minneapolis, Minnesota, who were demonized for their Somalian and or Latino backgrounds. Her actions, driven by caring and community, have too been demonized as leftist, as radical, or as, in the stinging words of the head of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, a domestic terrorist. Family related to Mrs. Good have described her as a Christian, and perhaps her faith moved her to care for her immigrant neighbors. The federal government, now openly in the grips of rightist ideology, sees U.S. citizens as enemies who may be executed if they don't obey their orders. Their position is actually crystal clear. Obey or die, period. Sound familiar? It should, for this was the message radiating from the Third Reich. This is the message of kings to their subjects. This is the message of power to the powerless. But people, thinking people, feeling people, have more power than they realize, for they have the power to say no. That power mattered to Renee Nicole Good. It should still matter to you. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Well, let's just go on and hear the next one. This is, again, his address to a conference in Heidelberg, Germany. And, yeah.
Return to the colonial mean. As I began contemplating events in search of a subject for the Luxembourg conference, day broke on the weekend with news of the U.S. kidnapping of Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores, removing them from their home and their country. It put me in mind of the Monroe Doctrine and the long, brutal history of U.S. imperialism, when America removed Latin American leaders like chess pieces, only to replace them with compliant puppets, the better to exploit their natural resources. We tend to think of colonialism and imperialism as simply economic systems, ever-present, almost natural in their ubiquity. That's because they seem normal to us because of that feature. But there was nothing normal nor natural about either colonialism or imperialism. That's because neither are neutral economic systems. They are systems of extraction and predation. They are also systems of extreme violence to obtain raw materials from the colonies, which are themselves systems of repression designed to steal labor and the life forces of the oppressed. Who can deny that the U.S. has supported, trained, and paid off the most repressive element in Latin American history for over a century to dominate such societies on behalf of the corporate, or should I say capitalist, interests of American business. What is America's interest? It's simple. It's capital. Why did the U.S. invade Venezuela? For its vast oil reserve. That rot about drugs was nothing but a pretext. Remember the weapons of mass destruction that the U.S. used to justify war in Iraq? A pretext. That's because colonialism, neocolonial, and its adjunct, imperialism, are but systems of predation and systems of repression. They're but systems built on capital acquisition, as in how to get more and more money. And that's just what we see in Venezuela. We're looking at a stick-up, courtesy of the U.S. military. All you need to do is see what you're seeing. To my friends at the Luxembourg Conference, I wish you love, not fear. Hier spreekt Mumia Abu Jamal. Thank you.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Luxembourg, what a venue. I don't know where I got the Heidelberg. I thought that was in the header. Prisonradio.org is where you can find that. And there's just an upwelling of commentary from rank and file, I guess I'll say. Prisoners. I haven't sorted through that. I might start featuring those when Mumia doesn't have a commentary. And this week he's had two. Good health to him. Yeah, the twist of the confiscated and extorted money has another, and I haven't read up on this as well as I should have, but the money that that oil was sold for, the money went to Qatar, banks in Qatar, not even, you know, New York banks. I guess Trump is in Davos this weekend. I was looking for a satiric song I thought I heard by Harry Shearer called Davos Man, but I guess I dreamt that. I'm sure he'll be posturing, and maybe he'll second his ambassador to Iceland's suggestion that maybe that should be the 52nd state. It would look good on a map, you know, if Greenland was also covered with a flag, as Stephen Miller's wife sent out soon. Maybe more on Davos Man tomorrow. Let's see. Let's go to Jamil Jaffer as part of Thursday's show. Just a 6-minute excerpt here. The Washington Post journalist who was shaken down. They even took her Apple Watch. Who had contacts all through the U.S. Government rank and file there, workers who were talking to her, something whisperer, government whisperer. But the in that interview, Amy brings up this other story that I think should get more currency. Steal this story, please. Yeah, I guess that's enough of an introduction. Again, this would have made a great start for an essay, particularly the part about the new anchor at CBS. Something flashed by, and I couldn't find it again, the list of people that he's interviewed, including 15 minutes with Trump in Detroit. I can't remember the name of the Tony Dockerell, something like that. His father was a drug dealer in Florida. Let's see. It would have been a great Breaking the Sound Barrier essay to pull some of those threads together like I'm not doing now. But here's part of that very important press freedom story.
Oversight Committee is facing growing criticism for voting to subpoena the prominent investigative reporter Seth Harp after he posted publicly available information about a Delta Force commander who reportedly played a role in the recent abduction of the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife. Harp's the author of the book, The Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking and Murder in the Special Forces. On Monday, 20 press freedom and First Amendment groups, including the ACLU and Reporters Without Borders, called on the House committee to rescind the subpoena, saying Harp's reporting is, quote, fully and squarely within the protections of the First Amendment. Your response,
yeah,
Jamel?
I mean, my organization didn't sign that letter, but I agree 100% with what the ACLU and other organizations wrote. I mean, this is plainly First Amendment protected activity. You can publish information that is already publicly available. And the fact that the government says that this information is classified doesn't actually change the calculus, because the First Amendment protects the right of news organizations and journalists to publish government secrets. So I think that this is, you know, yet another effort, this time by Congress, not the Justice Department, to intimidate the press, to deter the press from doing work that all of us need the press to do.
So you're racing out of here to catch a plane to go to Boston. You're dealing with the AAUP case that challenges the Trump administration's policy of detaining and deporting international students and professors who participate in pro-Palestine protests. Can you explain where this case stands now?
Yeah, so you know, this is, as you say, a case in which we're challenging this policy of targeting student protesters. And we had a trial over the summer before Judge Young, William Young, in Boston, after which he issued a 168-page opinion, scathing opinion, holding that the government's policy of targeting these foreign students on the basis of their pro-Palestinian activism was unconstitutional. So he's said that already, but he hasn't yet given us a remedy for the violations that he's identified. So today's hearing is about essentially what can the court do about the constitutional violations that he's already recognized. So it's a really important hearing. It's this afternoon in Boston.
And can you talk, next week marks the one-year anniversary of Trump having been in office, the attacks on the press that have happened in the last year.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's a terrible time for press freedom. And the important thing about that is that we need the press to inform the public about the government's actions and decisions and to help us hold government officials to account. But the Trump administration is, you know, engaged in a kind of all-out assault on press freedom. You see it in so many different ways. Like all from at the ground level, just the kinds of abuses that you see ICE agents and other federal officials engaged in, other federal agents engaged in with, you know, against reporters, but all the way up to the consolidation of control over some of the nation's largest media organizations, including CBS, and possibly soon TikTok and CNN as well.
Speaking of CBS, this is the new CBS news anchor, Tony DiCupio, closing out Tuesday night's broadcast with a salute to Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
For Rubio's hometown fans, which are many around here in Miami, it is a sign of how Florida, once an American punchline, has become a leader on the world stage. Marco Rubio, we salute you. You're the ultimate Florida man.
That was how, I think that was his first CBS newscast that he was hosting as the main host. So I wanted to go now to the Golden Globes, the comedian, the host, Nikki Glaser, who mocked CBS News during her opening monologue.
And the award for most editing goes to CBS News. Yes. CBS News, America's newest place to see BS News.
The Golden Globe ceremony aired on CBS and streamed on Paramount Plus. But let's not forget, CBS pulled that story on SECOT, on the Venezuelan prisoners, the U.S. Men who were sent to Venezuela and put at the maximum security prison in El Salvador.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, it's funny and sort of comical what's happening at CBS, but it's also tragic because we need the press to cover this stuff seriously. We need the press to hold government officials to account. And when some of the most powerful news organizations in the country aren't doing that, it makes our democracy much weaker.
Jamil Jaffer, we thank you so much for being with us, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Coming up, the acclaimed Iranian filmmaker, Jaffer Panahi.
And that's from Thursday. Going to go to a segment with a Palestinian filmmaker, also remembering the passing of a pretty famous, not that I'd heard about him, Palestinian actor. May get a posthumous Oscar, I suppose. CBS, yes. I didn't look for it, but it's out there, apparently. Barry Weiss having a little kiss on the cheek with Trump. Barry Weiss, who was installed by Larry Ellison to transform CBS. And as I mentioned, there was a list of the news for the common man that this Tony, the new host of the week, weekly new, daily news on CBS, was trying to do. The list is, Rubio and his ilk, including the 15-minute segment in Detroit with Trump himself. CBS, owned by a son of Larry Ellison, Project Oracle was a database with the CIA. That's where Ellison began his career. Now he owns Oracle. He took the name. I guess that's part of the privatization of intelligence. The CIA was Oracle's only customer for some time at the beginning. So, yeah, exactly that. I don't remember it being in Spies for Hire, but I guess I should go back and look at that. It's got a lot of mentions of SAIC, which is no longer here in brick and mortar, but I think it still has employees. That's a very... CIA backwards company that I've always been beating the drum about. They actually have a Venezuela connection. The first attempt to destabilize Chavez included a shutting down the oil industry, and SAIC, which mostly does intelligence, has a wing that does Halliburton kind of stuff supporting the oil industry. They had the contracts in Venezuela, and they sabotaged the pipeline systems and refinery control mechanisms from the inside, since it was their so that's not Oracle, that's and now we have Palantir, another quasi privatized intelligence. Palantir has a huge contract with ICE too, including possibly a DNA database. This is an untold story. I don't know if Amy's covered it or not. Should look that they have been swabbing these people that they detain temporarily. That detention watch segment, if you didn't hear that in the counter spin story, top of their show last hour. All right, my voice is failing. And I'll have some, didn't mention Radio Free Labor coming up. I hope Gus and Stephanie are in good voice today. And here's the segment, film being called All That's Left of You, another Oscar nominee. And this is part two, so there are other parts of the story that were included in the first part, which was broadcast on the WEFT, and this is a web exclusive. And I said Amy's not doing her column anymore, which was somehow being syndicated in the Knight newspapers, so I think that's related to the Knight Foundation of Jamil Jaffer's affiliation, former of AFCLU. Again, I had a flash on the MLK events thinking that maybe they were actually on Monday, but no, it's Sunday, 5 to 7. And if possible, I'll be twinning the YouTube broadcast of that event, maybe even catch the keynote from Carol Ammons if she speaks at the top of the hour at 5. It's 5 to 7. Doors open at the Cranard at 4 for that. And I guess I should reprise the Cure event. Champaign Urbana Resistance Effort, the fourth of their, or fifth of their series of rallies and other things. Tomorrow at 2 o'clock for just 1 hour, Frozen Chosen. It's at Westside Park, so maybe if you have errands to run, you can't stop. Drive by and blow your horn. It's always good when you're in a crowd like that to have some feedback from people in the area. All right, here's Amy's post-show with, I'll let her do the introduction.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with part two, our look at the film, All That's Left of You. It's by the acclaimed Palestinian-American director and actor Shireen Diabas. It's a feature film that looks at seven decades of Palestinian history through the lens of one family's experience over three generations, beginning in 1948. The film has been shortlisted for an Oscar. Shireen Diabas continues to join us in studio. Thanks so much for staying. So you laid out this film, this multi-generational film, starring you, yourself, and the Bakris. Mohammed died in December. It is so moving. Talk about how long this took you. This has been your lifelong dream.
It has, in many ways. You know, as a Palestinian-American who was born and raised in the West, my father was exiled from Palestine in 1967, and a lot like the characters in the film, he had to get foreign citizenship just to return to visit his family and the only home he'd ever known. And so I grew up with his heartache over his exile, and I also grew up going back home with him on these visits and seeing him harassed and humiliated at checkpoints. And I also grew up surrounded by Western headlines that dehumanized us, that that made us sort of nameless, faceless numbers. And I always wondered why that was the case and why people didn't know who we were and what happened to Palestinians in 1948 and how we became refugees. And so I always wanted to tell a Nakba story. And after I made my first two feature films, I really began thinking about this one. And this was back in 2014. And I decided to really sit with it and just take my time to develop it. So I actually sat with the story for 5 years and developed the characters and really came up with what was going to happen, what the structure was, how I was going to tell this multi-generational epic over all of these decades. And I read books. I immersed myself in different periods of Palestinian history and just really chose very carefully how to tell the story. I started writing the script in 2020. And, you know, so it's been more than a decade in the making. And it's just sort of, you know, especially considering what happened while we were attempting to shoot in Palestine, sort of feels like a miracle.
October 7th, 2023.
To this point, that's right.
And in part one, you started to talk about this, but talk about the grief of everyone at that point. You were in the West Bank, just about to start filming.
That's right. We were 2 weeks away from shooting, and we had done all of the work, all of the pre-production. You know, everything just came to a screeching halt, and we were just thrust into total uncertainty. You know, we didn't know if we'd be able to continue making the film, how, where. You know, my foreign crew was afraid and wanted to evacuate, understandably. You know, their families were worried. And so, you know, we had to leave. Not only leave all of our work behind, but leave behind our Palestinian crew, which was absolutely devastating. You know, we had spent so many months working so closely with an amazing, incredibly talented group of people, and we were all so excited to be showing these different moments in Palestinian history that had never before been seen in cinema. So at that point, we had to literally start from scratch. We had to figure out where to go. We were in a state of financial crisis, logistical crisis, And that was the state in which we made the film, was just constantly uncertain about whether we'd be able to continue, always raising more money because what we spent in Palestine was gone. You know, production that should have taken us a few months ended up taking us 11 months.
You
from
went
the time
to Cyprus.
We started shooting until the time we wrapped. We went to Cyprus first, and then we shot most of the film in Jordan, which is why it's Jordan's submission.
Submission for the Oscars.
For the Oscars. We shot most of the film in the Palestinian refugee camps in the north of Jordan, which was amazing because we got to work with the Palestinian refugee community in essentially what is the telling of their story, of our story, of all of our stories.
And explain, because this actually isn't a documentary. I mean, you play the star.
That's right. It's a fiction film that is the story of three generations of one family. And in many ways, you know, really takes a look at the collective trauma of the Nakba and the legacy of that trauma, the fact that the Nakba really never ended. And so it looks at the ongoing impact of that event on one Palestinian family over time and the continuing impact of the occupation. You know, occupation is such a benign term for something that is so brutally violent. And the movie shows, you know, very few moments of violence, and they're carefully chosen moments of violence, but it's really not about those moments. It's about the consequences of violence and the impact of violence on one family and how they're shaped through these political events that we see.
Mm. Tell us about your character, the woman that you play through the generations.
Well, the film really follows three generations of men. It is the story of three generations of men, a grandfather, a father, and a grandson, and in many ways traces the passage of trauma from one generation to another. My character is kind of the voice of the woman in the film and the storyteller. You know, she is, I play the wife of Saleh Bekri, and so I am the mother of the grandson or the teenage boy who we see at the beginning of the film in the protest, which, you know, is also kind of opens the trailer. And I am, you know, I'm telling the story. I'm attempting to heal the family through storytelling. And, you know, my husband and I in the film are faced with quite a moral conundrum. And that really is the heart of the movie.
So I want to actually dissect this more. It is not a spoiler to say that your son in the film dies, because he dies right away in the film. He is killed by Israeli forces.
That's
Talk
right.
about what he, what you faced as the mom in this dramatic narrative. You and your husband, played by Saleh Bekri, in trying to get him medical aid, though he's shot in the head.
That's right. So, you know, my character discovers that my son has been shot, and I race to where I can find him, where he's being tended to. He was shot during a protest in the section of the film that is the first intifada. The film takes place during four different time periods. So in the first intifada, he's shot at a protest. I race to find him. We take him to a hospital in the West Bank where he's treated. But when they reach the capacity of the treatment that they can do there at that hospital, they have to transfer him to a hospital in Israel. Proper in Haifa. And so my husband and I are then kind of made to get permits so that we can travel into Israel proper with our son. And then we discover in this process that we also need his ID and that he also needs a permit. And this process takes, you know, a couple of days and, of course, just delays the really vital treatment that our son needs. So through this, you know, event, we sort of see the bureaucratic violence that is imposed on Palestinians all the time, sadly.
I wanted to go back to a clip we played in part one of this conversation, and not the trailer, but the scene where, at this point, Mohammed Bekri is the grandfather, his son, played by his actual son, Saleh, and his grandson. It really focuses on the grandpa and the grandchild, which goes to this issue of generational trauma.
The military invasion of Lebanon, known as Operation Litani, and the following massacres.
What's the rush? Can't even greet your grandpa, your sweetheart, your best friend? Who else do you have? What a crazy family. I smell the scent of a human.
Grandpa. I'm too old for that game.
Too old. You? With Grandpa, you can never grow up, especially not with this game. Take it back. Take it back. Take it back.
No.
Take it back.
Okay, okay, I take it back.
How was school?
Boring.
I had a feeling you'd say that. That's why I have a surprise for you.
A scene from All That's Left of You. The grandfather there is played by the noted, world-renowned Palestinian actor and director, Mohammed Bakri. Describe this scene for us and what you're conveying in it for people who haven't seen it.
Well, this scene takes place during the 1970s portion of the film where we see all the three generations on screen together, grandfather, father, and grandson. And you really get to see how their identities are shaped in relationship or in opposition to each other and in relationship to what's happening outside, you know, in Palestine. And in this particular scene, you see the really special relationship between the grandfather and the grandson. You know, the grandfather, you know, Mohammed Bakri, you know, it's hard to watch this scene because he's so missed. And it was so amazing to work with him in this. You know, the character of Mohammed Bakri in this scene, and really throughout this portion of the film, is really teaching his son or his grandson about Palestine, about what they had, about what Palestine was, about Yaffa, like really instilling in him their history and where they come from. And so you really see how the father, Saleh Bekedi's character, kind of rejects this living in the past and just really wants to kind of forget the past and live in peace right now and sort of make the best of what they have. But you see that Mohammed Bekedi's character is just really holding on, and it's causing him a lot of suffering. And he's passing that past and that history onto his grandson. And so you see this conflict between the three generations.
And a song at the end of that scene?
That is actually the national anthem. That is the Palestinian national anthem. It's actually an anthem that's used throughout the Arab world, but Palestinians used it as their national anthem, you know, for many decades, and definitely in the 70s. And so they're sort of bonding over this this moment of just love for their country.
I wanted to weave in who Mohammed Bakri is within this film and outside, best known for his 2002 documentary, Jenin, Jenin, featuring the voices of Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp following this devastating Israeli military operation that killed 52 Palestinians. In 2007, we spoke to Mohammed Bakri on Democracy Now! About interviewing survivors of the Jenin massacre.
They wanted to tell their stories because they were still in shock. When I came in Jenin, I was shocked with what I saw. I couldn't think, I couldn't feel. I was really just humiliated as a human being, not as a Palestinian, not as a director, not as an actor, just as a human. How come people can do such things like that in the camp?
That is Mohammed Bakri, who died in December. How did that his experience and his sons, Adam and Saleh, who also star in this film, inform this film that is also really about your life and your family, your generations, coming right through to living here today in the United States?
Well, they brought so much of their own personal experience as Palestinians living in Palestine. I learned, talking to Saleh very early on, that his mother is actually from Yaffa, and he was born in Yaffa. And at the age of 5 years old, they moved to his father's village. And so, and he was sad to leave Yaffa. So in many ways, he really related to the character of Sanim that he plays in the film. And, you know, to be able to cast a real family, it was really such a dream. I mean, to bring, you know, to make this an intergenerational portrait, both on screen and off screen, they brought so much of their own relationship dynamics, especially Mohammed and Saleh, who have many, many scenes together in the 1970s portion of the film. They're on screen quite often playing father and son. And they just brought so much emotional depth and nuance from their own relationship that I just never would have been able to, I think, capture if I had cast, you know, non-family members. It was really beautiful to see them together and to see them working together. And, you know, not only do they resemble each other physically, but they also have similar, they sound alike and they have similar mannerisms. And so you suspend disbelief and you really kind of go along with the fact that you're watching a family. And actually, I also want to mention Mohammed Bekri's nephew plays teenage Noor, the teenager who's shot at the beginning of the film. So it's actually four generations of one family. And teenage Noor is Mohammed Abdurrahman, who's an incredibly talented young actor. And as you can see, he looks so much like Saleh in the family. And it was just, for me, really like just my dream cast.
Can you tell us how, when he died, how his life was honored in Palestine and in Israel?
Well, I mean, you know, I wish I could have been there, but I wasn't. My understanding was that there was just a huge service and it looked like just massive amounts of people showed up, Palestinian and Israeli, though I'm sure, you know, Saleh could probably speak better to that. But there was just such a huge outpouring of love for him that I saw all over social media. I mean, that was the part that I really, you know, was so moved by, that it was so clear that Muhammad touched so many people and left behind such a legacy. And, you know, Saleh recently introduced All That's Left of You at our premiere in Palestine. We finally got to return home. We got to return the film home for our premiere in Ramallah. And he told this beautiful story that basically ended with him saying, you know, that Muhammad doesn't die, that his dad doesn't die, that he's someone who lives on in our hearts, in the legacy that he left behind, in his incredibly talented children who continue to just, you know, carry his torch and his love and his passion, not only for cinema, but for a free Palestine. And for him, those two things were the same. They were one and the same.
Tell us how this was received in Ramallah. You were right outside Ramallah where you were supposed to film, and of course, in the end, you couldn't.
That's right. We were actually, our production was based in Ramallah during the events of October the 7th. And we had to evacuate from there and leave our crew behind, which was so devastating. And it was so beautiful to see that we had a sold-out screening, that the theater was totally packed, and that it was very emotional. I got so many messages afterward. It just felt that there was, it felt like there was so much love for the film, but also for Muhammad, who was honored at that screening.
So if you can talk about, without me saying, spoiling one of the storylines in your film, at the heart of the film is this unique moral quandary that addresses the inevitably intertwined fates of Palestinian and Israeli society. Both the concessions of Palestinians who seek to live their lives in dignity and an Israeli society that enabled genocide and apartheid. Talk about that without, I guess, giving away what actually happens in the film, which is based on a true story.
That's right. Our couple at the heart of the film, the character that I play and Saleh Bekri, who plays my husband, we are faced with a moral dilemma. And, you know, this is a moral dilemma that in any other context might not be a moral dilemma. It's just a choice. And in any other context, it wouldn't be such a loaded, such a politically charged choice. But within this context, it is. And you really see our characters go about making this decision in a very careful, very well thought out way. They go and they consult with an imam and they try to understand, you know, sort of the religious, what the religious advice might be in this moral quandary. And I think ultimately what I wanted to do by introducing this in the film and putting this at the heart of the film was to really broaden the scope of the film and to talk about why Palestinians are suffering. You know, the fact that Palestinians are paying such a high price for European persecution of the Jewish people. And I wanted to really talk about how our fates are intertwined, that at this point, the Palestinians can't be safe without the safety of the Jewish people, and the Jewish people can't be safe without the safety of the Palestinian people. And so that was really kind of where the movie goes. That's really where I wanted the movie to go in the end, and where the movie does go in the end, to really then also kind of leave the audience with whether or not they would make that choice, and whether or not, you know, they would choose humanity the way that our couple does. You know, Palestinians resist in all kinds of ways. And one of the ways that I've seen Palestinians resist again and again is by choosing humanity. You know, the forces of oppression want us full of hate. They want our hearts full of hate and anger. That's how they dehumanize us. You know, but when we hold on to who we are, when we hold on to our love, when we hold on to our humanity in these unbelievably difficult circumstances, then I think that's when we win. And I know it's incredibly difficult to do and, you know, easy for me to say from my position of privilege, but I must say that because I'm not living in, you know, in under the threat of violence, I feel even more responsibility to kind of really make sure that I'm holding my humanity.
As I look at you now, I mean, you're the director of this film, but you also star in it, the mom of the boy who's killed by the Israeli forces, and we watch you age throughout. Talk about, I mean, like Mohamed Bakri, he was an actor, he was also a director.
That's
but
right.
Talk about what this meant for you to star in the film and also direct it. How do you do that?
Well, it was tremendously challenging, I have to say. I mean, absolutely, just a radical shift in perspective to go from acting to directing. You know, you're directing, when you're directing, you're sort of looking at the world through the widest possible lens, and you know everything that's going to happen, and everything is crystal clear. And then you jump into, you know, the role, and you're on camera, and you have to forget everything and zoom into the longest possible lens and just focus on this one perspective. And so it's this constant mind game, you know, this kind of schizophrenic, radical shift in perspective that is tremendously challenging. But I learned so much by diving into this part and playing this character. I must say she taught me so much grace and humility. And in many ways, I really wanted to do it because I felt such a kinship with her in that she is, you know, in so many ways trying to heal the family through telling this story. You know, we at the beginning of the film, we see that she's speaking directly to us, the audience. But at the end of the film, we discover she's actually talking to someone and telling someone her family story in order to try to bring some closure or some healing or some sense of relief to what they've been through. And I think that I, as the filmmaker, was also looking to tell the story to explore my own intergenerational trauma and see if I could bring some kind of healing or at least transform that trauma into something useful through this film.
So we're speaking as the film is opening around the country. It just opened at the Lemley in Los Angeles. It's at the Roxy in San Francisco.
That's right.
Here in New York, it's at New Plaza on the Upper West Side. It's at Angelica. It's at Kips Bay. But it's going beyond New York. It's opening in Chicago as we speak.
Chicago, Miami, many other cities. That's right, today.
And most people don't think about the process of how films open and where they open. It is quite something that the film shortlisted for the Oscar, whether in the dramatic narrative category like yours and The Voice of Hind Rajab. There are a number of Palestinian films and Israeli-Palestinian films. But it is extremely difficult for these films to get distribution. Talk about what it means to have these films come out, what it means for audiences to come out to see these films.
Yeah, these films have historically not gotten major distribution or major streaming. You know, Watermelon Pictures was formed in recent years in order to really, you know, take these movies on and do them justice. They felt it was really important to get these movies out into the world and get them seen. And so I've partnered with them to get this movie out. And really, I mean, it's so imperative that people support these films. You know, if they're not seen in cinemas, then there's just no other way for them to be seen. And there's no other way to prove that there is an audience for these films. And therefore, filmmakers like myself will not get to continue telling these stories. And, you know, with a story like this, a story that's been omitted from history books, that has been denied, that is actively still being denied and censored and suppressed, it is really an act of resistance. Not just to make the film, but to support the film. It's an act of solidarity to buy a movie ticket. It is an act of resistance to show up at the movie theater and support and watch this film. And I also think that the film, you know, I think that people will be surprised by the film. I think that, you know, the film isn't just about devastation and kind of these decades of political events. This is a film about a family. It's a film about the love that it takes to survive all of this. It has tenderness and compassion and humor. And I think there's many different colors within it. So I think that people will also really find that they're quite entertained. I think people often think that watching Palestinian films is like eating broccoli or something, you know, but a lot of these films that we're seeing now are really, they're also made to entertain and to really bring an audience in and to be seen on the big screen with a group of people, you know. And I really think that there is kind of collective healing and coming together in watching these films, especially
about
with
that. I mean, that's so important because we may be seeing the end of theaters as we know it. We're around the corner from a movie theater that was just taken down and it's going to be a condo or something.
Yeah, it's so sad. I mean, I think it's really amazing to walk into a room, to go into a dark room with a bunch of strangers, to put your phone aside. You know, these days we are so distracted by our phones. We're constantly just on them. But to be able to just sit and focus and immerse yourself in an emotional story. And, you know, cinema's all immersive. immersive. You know, you have the big picture, you've got the surround sound, you've got the reactions of the people around you, and it really creates a different environment. It's a different experience, it's a different kind of immersion. And I think with films like this, it's also a bit of a collective grieving and a collective catharsis. And I really think with everything we've seen in the last couple of years, we need that. That I think that there's something healing in that for those of us who are far away and who've been just witnessing all of the devastation. You know, I've heard amazing stories about strangers meeting each other after screenings, just having deep conversations about what they just saw, hugging each other during the credits because, you know, they see that the person next to them is sobbing and they you know, they want to be there for them. Just really beautiful.
Well, I'm timing out, pardon me, that you can hear all of that. And there's just a few minutes left. They talk about No Other Land, as it's called. That won the Oscar for documentary last year. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, the Palestinian partner, the Israeli guy, was targeted and was killed in the